Welcome to the Earn More, Stress Less podcast with me, Caro Sison. This podcast is for self-employed business owners just like you, who really want to grow their business and become successful and profitable, but without all the stress and hassle. I want to share my 30 years of business experience to show you how simple it can be to earn more money and how you can get organized without needing a business degree or any other qualifications. I'll be talking about the easy steps that you can put in place right now to start earning more money today and to help you get the business that you deserve and dream of. Without further ado, let's get started. This week's podcast is sponsored by Pocket PA, helping self-employed business owners to get organized, understand their finances, and do their accounts all in one place using a powerful online tool. If you're serious about making a profit and having a successful business, then using a simple digital web app like Pocket PA is the best way to grow and scale your business. Visit pocketpa.com for more details and start managing your money like a pro today. Hello and welcome to the Earn More, Stress Less podcast with me, Caro Sison. Thank you so much for listening today, and I've got a really great episode for you because today I am talking with Ellie Austin-Williams, aka This Girl Talks Money. Now, she's the co-host of a very successful podcast called Money Unfiltered, and she's basically your financial wingwoman, your money educator, content creator, and most importantly, coffee lover. She's a total powerhouse providing knowledge, insights, and a really safe space to help people gain confidence and ownership of your finances. And she's building an incredible community of financially empowered women, which I really, really love. It's so important. So welcome, Ellie. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. That was an incredible intro. I feel like I need to package that up and take it with me everywhere. But yeah,
it's so true.
Oh, thank you. But it's lovely to be here and to talk about some of these topics, which are so important.
100%. So I think money is just such a taboo subject in so many areas, and it's sometimes seen as a dirty word, or people associate it with bragging or things that they just feel uncomfortable with. So I love the idea that you are talking openly about so many topics around money, because people just have this feeling about it and they're not quite sure how to put their finger on it. So firstly, can you just tell us your journey to this point? Because I'd love our listeners to hear how you got into becoming such an expert in finances and decided to sort of shine this light on it. It's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a bit of a squiggly journey, really. I am the textbook kind of squiggly career person. I started my working life out as a lawyer. So I actually out of university had a training contract, so I went to law school, did that for a couple of years, and it really was one of those things where I just decided that I was going to be a lawyer, and that was the path I set myself on. I didn't really think about, you know, what my skills were, what would suit me, whether it really was the right fit. And so once I moved to London and I started working, really, I came across a few people, and I met one of my best friends who also was a lawyer at this point, but a few years older than me. And she was figuring out how to kind of get out of law, and she wanted to go into marketing. And she actually ended up setting up her own marketing agency. And so I spent more and more time whilst I was working, training as a lawyer, with her, figuring out what she did with the company, helping her to come up with like the strategy, and really just learning marketing on the job, but in between doing a full-time job. So I was up to points, I was basically working like 1.5 times in terms of how much I was working. And really, I wasn't loving my life as a lawyer. I'm not sure that it was the firm that I was at, it just didn't really kind of suit me particularly. There were aspects of it that I did enjoy and that I do kind of still miss in ways, but basically, the opportunity was there. Once I qualified, I either stayed as a lawyer, went down that route, or I thought, you know, this is going to be the best time to take a risk. You've got the qualification, you can come back. So I did it. I left and went and joined my friend's marketing agency, which was a whirlwind. It was very small, it was growing quickly, and learned so much there. And that's really when I started to have the idea for This Girl Talks Money. I guess I probably had the idea a bit earlier, but I had no capacity to think about what to do with it and whether there was legs to it. And my initial idea really came down to the fact that there was nothing out there I could find online that talked to young women primarily about money. I wanted to know how to make better decisions about my finances, but I didn't want to be patronized. I didn't want to be told, don't spend any money, you need to save everything. I didn't want to be told, you know, do what you want. I knew that I needed to learn some basics, but I didn't know where I was going to learn that from. And everything felt like it was aimed at people, like, well, at my mum, really, or at men. So I started with a blog. I started writing a blog, just really sharing the things that I had taught myself about money and that I had learned from reading and researching. And it's kind of grown from there. That was the very beginning. In between there and now, there's been lots of different things that I've done, more qualifications, more research, more writing. But yeah, really, I think I just realized that if I wanted to find out more about money as a 20-something female, then there were probably other people that did too.
I think that's so interesting, because what you were saying was something that I see all the time, where there seems to be this hamster wheel of children and kids going into education and then reaching that sort of age of 17, 18, leaving, and then going onto this hamster wheel of further education, needing to get a degree or a qualification that then puts them into an employed role. And then they move into this job and corporate world. And they're often then just tied into doing this thing every single day, you know, 8-9 hours a day that they aren't particularly passionate about. And then they start to get credit card debt, they start to get some finance, they might buy a car. And then there's this whole conflict of, well, I need to keep my job because I've got commitments and I need to keep paying for it. And, you know, if I did something that I really loved, it's going to be taking a risk and, you know, it's not going to be steady income. There's no certainty. So I better just stay in this employed role. And it just goes on. And then before you know it, you're married and then you've got some children, and then it's just all imploding. And you actually sort of reach some point, maybe in your late 20s or early 30s, when you think, gosh, I'm not actually doing anything that lights me up, but I want to earn some money. And I don't think I particularly want that sort of rigidity of a corporate job where I'm employed or whatever it is. But you're not quite sure what to do, but you've got these financial commitments because you got into them so early, because people often live on the never never and they want something now and pay for it tomorrow. So there aren't enough conversations, certainly for, I think, the young people, of firstly thinking about something sensible that they want to do, that they are really committed to or passionate about at that very early stage when they're leaving school. And secondly, it is around those conversations of getting those financial commitments very early on before they really understand the impact of credit agreements and all of those sorts of things. Is that your experience?
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I think on the careers point, it's a huge challenge. I think that I'm optimistic today that because there is so much more access to information online, then people, I'm hoping, do have more of an idea of what options are out there, which was not the case when I was younger. But it's also just quite overwhelming. I mean, if you'd have asked me what I wanted to do at 17, 18, or even at 22, 23, I would not have known. And so I kind of just went with the best bet that I could kind of find. And I actually think this is starting to change, but I do think that thankfully it's becoming more normal and common to change and to flex your career and to change direction and to try something different. I think there is that fear often that it won't work out. And, you know, there is a reality that the system like that we live in doesn't really help out self-employed or business owners. Like, it doesn't give you the same kind of structure or reliability. Everything is kind of built for employed people. But there are also massive, massive benefits to it, which, you know, I would never have said that I think I actually actively chose to be self-employed or to be a business owner. It wasn't like a conscious decision. It's just the where I've ended up. And, you know, there are parts of me that sometimes think, oh, I wish I was still employed, like, because it would be nice to be able to have a sick day and to not to impact like how much I'm paid or whatever. But on the whole, it really does suit me much much better. There are so many aspects of self-employment that I think do suit a lot of personalities and skill sets. And, you know, we're not taught about that at all. I wasn't. You know, I think, again, schools are becoming much more entrepreneurial and business minded, but I don't think that that was something that I really thought about. I didn't know how you work for yourself or how you start business and like whether that might be something that I could do and actually could do well.
There's not an academy or a college of further education to help you work for yourself or learn all of the skill sets. And they certainly don't teach those at school because there's a lot of other things that they're cramming into that curriculum. But I certainly think at that point that they're moving people into further education. The actual financial impact of people moving into higher education, like a degree or university place, where they're then sort of saddling themselves with a debt of the student, you know, the student loan, which could be anything from, you know, 27,000 up to 50,000 or above, depending on the length of your course. That's a very big financial commitment that I'm not sure it's explored enough sometimes before they actually make that big decision to go into further education. Do you recognize that?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think, again, we're starting to see more awareness of that. I do think it's important to kind of distinguish it from like credit card consumer debt in the sense that it really behaves more like a income. It has a huge knock on how much money you see at the end of the month when you're earning. The big difference being that obviously if you don't earn enough to hit the threshold, you don't pay it back. So you don't have the same kind of obligation as you would have with consumer debt. But it is something that I think increasingly people are starting to think about and question whether it's something that is necessary and something that they want. And I'm quite pro-university, but I am very aware that I went at a time where student tuition fees were a lot less. I went when it was still capped at around 3,000 a year. So my student debt is very different to what people's student debt looks like today. I do think there's more to university than just the education. I think the experience is brilliant, but I don't think you necessarily need to pay the amount of money that you do pay for the experience. And of course, there are going to be jobs where you do have to go and get a degree. I couldn't have become a lawyer in the time that I became a lawyer had I not gone to university. Now there are more routes though opening up to be able to do apprenticeships, and I think that's brilliant. I think that there should be more routes, because actually I think what's happening is that university is becoming something that only like the wealthy are going to be able to afford, because even with student loans, then it's still so expensive to live. And I think a lot of people are starting to question whether it's the right path.
Yeah, I think that would be such a shame if the whole avenue of further education was shut down based on a monetary decision, because that will exclude large swathes of the country from having that opportunity. And education is definitely key. I just think there could potentially be a better balance of how it's paid for. But that's, you know, that's another whole conversation. But moving on, why do you think money is such a taboo subject? What is the roots, do you think, in us finding it so awkward and difficult to have these conversations or initiate them and get them started? Because once you do get on a roll and you feel in a safe space, people love to chat about it, but there's often that sort of reticence or nervousness about bringing something up in case it's awkward.
Yeah, I think it goes back to often like what we observe, what we see when we're younger. I don't think it's something that is inherent. I think it is a learnt behavior that talking about money and being open about our finances is something that is not really polite or not particularly done. And I think we form our set of beliefs around money by the age of 7. And that's not just the beliefs that we're conscious of, it's our subconscious behaviors around money. And a lot of us have experience, and our parents have experience, and their parents have experienced messages that are saying, you know, it's rude to ask people about finances. I don't really know why we do have this real kind of, I guess, close tie between, I guess, ourselves and our image of ourselves and our finances. But I guess it's a result probably of like society and the way that our society operates, which is very capitalist and where a lot of value is placed on material gain and wealth. So a lot of us subconsciously or consciously think that when we disclose our financial situation, then it kind of, you know, it invites a judgment on us and how, you know, successful or not successful we are, or how good a person we are, or whatever, which, you know, obviously are completely untrue, but we have that fear of judgment from others based on the information that we put forward and put out into the world. And so in a way it feels like, well, the easiest way to avoid that judgment is not to share any information.
Yeah, I think that's so true. This fear of judgment that our worth might be caught up with what, you know, the income pay packet, the amount that we're earning in our business or whatever. It's just so closely intertwined. And, you know, the ego is out there, and this day of consumerism where Instagram showreel seem to rule, and the type of lifestyle that you're affording, the car that you're driving, the place that you live or you rent or that you've bought is all a reflection, you know, directly on yourself. And there's so much caught up with people's sort of impression, I suppose, perhaps misconceived, that you are what you're earning and how successful you are is completely based on a monetary value and how much money you might have in the bank, when in fact so many other things create wealth and make you so much richer and happier and more content. But there is this such tight-knit correlation of it. So yeah, that's certainly been my experience. And I think the sort of separation between your business and your personal finances as well, certainly as a small business owner, they can get so enmeshed and intertwined. Has that been your experience?
Oh my gosh, yeah, 100%, especially when I started. So now I would say I'm very good at separating the two, and I really don't treat my business finances as my own, probably to the degree that I actually don't take advantage of like some of the I guess, benefits of having a company that I could. I'm very, very clear that they're separate. But I think for a lot of people, there is a real overlap, and it becomes tricky because, you know, as a small business owner, you do spend so much of your time and your energy thinking about and focusing on your business that it can become your identity. And so the success or failure of your business, you can really feel it as your own. And again, they're completely distinct things. I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, having separate accounts is so important. But also sometimes just, you know, having a separate name for your business that is not your own name, it can really help to separate the two in your head as well as practically, just so that you can objectively look at the business if you can, and treat it as you would treat someone else's business, and look at it as, you know, what's working, what's not working, like, rather than seeing it as like, oh, it's not working because of me. And of course, you know, there are some overlaps. There is some level of like personal responsibility if you are the sole person operating it. But there are other things that are not always in your control that are going on within a business and whether the business is doing well or not. So I think having that separation is so important.
Yes. And what are some of the biggest struggles that you see people having with their personal finances that people reach out to you to ask questions about or seek your help?
Gosh, yeah. I mean, there are lots of things. I mean, a lot of the time I spend talking to people is just really about demystifying processes or parts of personal finance, which are so integral to kind of how we operate, but that aren't really clear. So a prime example being mortgages. Mortgages are something that pretty much everyone thinks about or has at some point, and they're really confusing. They're really one of the most unstraightforward financial products, I think, that exists. And why baffles me, because they are so much money that it should be the number one thing people understand if you're going to go and take out several hundred thousand pounds of loan. But yet, for some reason, like the whole industry is just quite old fashioned, very antiquated, and you just kind of, I think people just go along with it and they don't always ask questions. So once you start prompting those questions, people think, oh, actually, like maybe I should ask a few more questions, or I should think about this or explore another option. So those types of topics, I mean, investing is another one which comes up all the time, that I have loads of questions from people in my community about just these parts of personal finance, which are so important, but that nobody has really ever taught us or made simple.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I retrained when I was 33 as a mortgage broker because I really wanted to unpack and understand such a big financial commitment. I mean, that's a bit of an extreme to go off and train as a mortgage broker to do that. But after that, once I was qualified with my CMAP exams, I then was giving mortgage and financial advice on that basis. So I really understood it. And it was so important to me when I went to see clients who were either needing to purchase or remortgage a property for the first time, that they understood actually the financial commitment that they were entering into. Because I think for most people, the only thing that they want to know is, can I afford this house? How much can I borrow? How much is the monthly payment going to be? And they don't look beyond that monthly payment. They just look at that affordability, when in fact, the actual length and the term of the loan will dictate the thousands and often hundreds of thousands extra that you may well pay. And the differences in these percentage rates a little bit, or whether your risk profile determines that you need certainty with a fixed rate, or whether you're a little bit more sort of flexible and you're prepared to do a tracker or a discounted rate. But all of these terms are completely alien, because at school you have no idea what the heck's a discounted or a tracker rate mortgage, and why would I ever need to know that, or that's too complicated for me. But when I sat down with people and actually explained it in really simple terms, which is very possible to do, and every mortgage broker should be able to do that, suddenly people's eyes lit up and they felt like they had unpacked a little bit of knowledge that they'd never known before. And it was going to be such an important thing, because they were going to have a mortgage commitment for sort of 20, 30, 40 years, the majority of their adult life. And yet nobody had ever explained the importance of compound interest and overpayments and what a huge impact that sort of thing can have. So certainly as a mum, I felt that as a responsibility as a mum to explain that to my kids. But I had that against the backdrop of being a mortgage broker, because I had gone into that very narrow and deep and decided I needed to educate myself. You know, clearly people don't need to go to that extreme. And that's, you know, a part of my personality that I do that. But relaying that information and sort of shining a light for the younger generation to do that is so, so important and so valuable, because as you say, these are such huge financial commitments. Do you talk a lot about credit cards and sort of repayments and that sort of financial debt when you're sort of talking about your money topics?
Yeah, so it is something that comes up quite a lot, and I'm very keen to kind of educate people again around it. I would say that on the whole, I think my audience are quite literate when it comes to credit. And it's, I mean, I don't think for a second that that is kind of reflective of the state of the country. I think that it's, again, a topic which is very confusing and is shrouded in words and abbreviations and confusion. It's a topic that I think has to be dealt with very kind of objectively, again, in the sense that credit is not bad objectively. Like, it's not a bad thing. It's a very useful thing. And we work in a system where you need to make it work for you, really. Like, if you don't engage with credit in the modern banking system, then it will penalize you on things like mortgages. But it's far too accessible. It's far too easy to get hold of. And mostly, and I think it's the key, is that people don't understand it. So people don't understand how to use it to their advantage and how to get the most out of having credit. And I mean, again, I kind of understand why, because the banks, it's not in banks' interest, really, is it, for people to know exactly how to use credit to their advantage and to not pay interest when using credit. But at the same time, like, I feel like banks do have a responsibility. Where the line is, who knows? And I guess that's what everyone's trying to figure out. How much responsibility should banks have for what they lend to people without people really knowing what they're signing up to? But it always surprises me that, like, every few months or so, my husband will get an email from the credit card company or a letter saying, oh, congrats, we've increased your credit limit. And he never has once asked them to increase his credit limit. They just do it, and they just hope that you're going to spend it.
And yeah, I was invited last week to say, what would you like your credit limit to be? We haven't moved it up for 5 years. Would you like to apply for a larger credit limit? And I popped in an extra 10,000, and within a nanosecond, it had come back and said, oh, your credit limit is now an extra 10,000. I thought, crikey dicks, that's like crazy that it's I could so just quick. In the sweep of a couple of keys in my keyboard, I had suddenly had an extra 10,000 available to me. Yeah. And you know, I do understand how to use credit very well to my advantage. I repay it every month. And, you know, but there are lots of things in the background that people don't understand necessarily, and how it might impact your credit score and that sort of thing. And it sounds like you've got a very, as you say, financially literate and very interested and engaged audience. So that might not necessarily be that cross section of, you know, the UK population. But certainly for my listeners, I sort of try to enlighten them with their business finances. But because, you know, these are small business owners, there's such a lot of overlap between personal finances and business finances. I know some people with small businesses, they don't even have a separate business bank account. So these things are all very intertwined. What are your thoughts around sort of finances where you've got your partner as well, about having separate access to money? Are those sorts of things talked about in your community? Whether people should have joint bank accounts or separate bank accounts or their own rainy day money, or how that makes people feel?
Absolutely. This is a big topic that comes up a lot, and it's very contentious, I think, because people have really different views on it. But my view kind of on all of it comes back to the fact that ultimately, I think being involved and communication are the absolute key factors that you need. How you go about that and how you achieve that is going to look different based on different personalities, different setups, different ways that you organize your money, personal preferences. So when it comes to relationships, ultimately, I do not think that hiding money is ever really a good idea. There are people that will always advocate for, you know, having like a, like you say, like a secret, like escape fund, an F off fund, which I agree with, but I don't think it needs to be a full secret. I don't think that the idea of having £10,000 hidden from somebody that you are in a committed long-term relationship from is really setting you up for success. Because if they find out that you've got £10,000 hidden, that's probably not going to do much for your relationship, and vice versa. And that's what I always say to people. I always say, think about it the other way around. Like, how would you feel if the shoe was on the other foot? Do I think that we should be having our own bank accounts? 100%. And me and my husband both have separate bank accounts. We do have a joint account, which is where we operate from day to day, but we have our own savings accounts. We have our own credit cards, but we just have transparency as well. So we know how much is in each of the accounts. The only one he doesn't really have that much visibility over is my business account. But if he asks me, I'll tell him. Like, there's nothing that I'm trying to hide. And actually, in some ways, because of having the business and how my business finances operate, actually, like, that is very much my money. I am the sole director. Like, I'm the only person that can access that. So that is, in a way, a bit of a safety net for me. But I do have my own accounts that he can't access. I just don't see any reason why I wouldn't tell him what is in those accounts. Because, like I said, I think you have to look at all of the areas of the relationship, and trust and communication are fundamental for any successful relationship in all areas. And money is no different. And I think people always find it interesting as well. Like, and I find it fascinating looking at how people behave with money in their own relationships and then looking at their parents. And both me and my husband have come from divorced parents, where actually, particularly with my husband's parents, money was a real big cause of conflict. And it's meant that we have been very open and tried to really talk about it regularly from quite early on, because we know that it is a topic, an area where it can become really problematic if you don't do that. So for me, I always will say to people, like, if you want to have completely separate accounts, great. If you want to have joint accounts, great. I would always encourage people to maintain something where they have just their name on it, but you don't need to be hiding money and how much you communicate about money. It's about finding a rhythm and a routine that works for you.
Yeah, I agree. And I just think if you have to have a secretive just in case account, that's a real red flag and a marker on where you are in your relationship, perhaps with your partner. And that will need addressing sooner rather than later, because secreting money away, it's one thing buying that pair of shoes or a handbag or, you know, getting, I don't know what boys buy, lawnmowers or whatever it is. But, you know, to actually have a secret account, again, like you said, imagine how you would feel if you knew that your partner had squirreled away a big sum of money just in case he was going to leave you. You know,
that's destabilizing,
isn't it, for your relationship?
It is. And you can always say to your partner, you know, I'm keeping like a few thousand pounds in this bank account. That's just my money. I want it as a safety net. Like, absolutely do that. But, you know, there's no reason not to tell them that. They can't access it still. It's your bank account. But it's just that transparency, I think, and that honesty, which is what is so important.
Yeah, agreed. So if people are listening today and they're thinking, gosh, I really do need to be a bit more responsible with my money, what might be some simple first steps that people can take who, if they're listening today, to help them get more comfortable managing their money? What would you suggest is the first step, Ellie?
So honestly, I would say that knowledge is power. It's one of those really kind of cheesy sayings, but it's so true when it comes to money. The more information you have, the better. So even if it's something that you really don't want to do, you've been putting it off, try and set aside 20 minutes, half an hour, and go through your finances. Look at the big picture. And I always use the analogy of a car and a journey. And if you want to set off on a journey to a destination, to your end goal destination, you need to know where your car is parked before you can even think about the journey. And getting that picture, that bird's eye view of what is going on right now in your finances, is like locating your car. You need to have an idea of what's coming in, what's going out, where there are any leaky holes, what's in savings, what do you owe, all of those figures. Once you've got a picture of that, you can start making better decisions. But I think for a lot of people, even that, getting to the point where you are looking at those numbers, staring at them in black and white, is quite scary and quite daunting. And I do understand that, but I really would encourage people to start with that. And, you know, if it feels overwhelming, then break it down. Start off with looking at what's coming in every month. And then tomorrow or a couple of days later, go through your expenses. But just getting a big picture of, yeah, your kind of financial landscape, what is going on in the different sections, is going to be the starting point.
Yeah, it's that ground zero point, isn't it? Where am I now? Because if you've got ambitions to either open and start a business that might need a little bit of finance, or you're really planning that big holiday getaway or a big celebration or that big expenditure cost, or, you know, saving for a house or a deposit, you've got to see how realistic it is. And if you've got heaps of credit card debt and you're never opening that envelope to know that you've got that tax bill, or you've got money in debt and things that you're just pretending isn't there, you really haven't got that 360 view to be able to make sensible decisions. And whilst it might be, you know, very hot under the collar and sweaty palm moment to actually have a look at those numbers in black and white, it is your true financial north. And there's no point pretending that you're, you know, facing north when in fact you're actually heading directly south, and you're going under and under. And the longer that you ignore it, the actual worse it's probably going to get. So I'm a great believer, write it all out, put it on a spreadsheet, put it in black and white, just so that you can see it and understand where you might have all of your little pots of money, and then understand any sources of income that you've got, and then just sit with it and look at it and sort of percolate it for a little while and just think, oh, gosh, I didn't know all that was happening, or gosh, how did that happen, or whatever. And then just starting to get comfortable with it, because everything can change. Nothing is, you know, nothing is set in stone. This is just a starting point, and where you begin is never where you end up. It's always just that sort of moment in time. It's just that snapshot. And things, you know, if you don't think that they're great, they can always get better and be improved upon. And, you know, money worries, they don't go away just by ignoring them. And if, in fact, if you do, I feel that they can get bigger and bigger to such a point where it feels so overwhelming that you feel hopeless and you think that you can never get out. And then you start to perhaps turn it inwards and, you know, there's this shame around the fact that you're not managing your money or whatever, or that you've got into debt. And, you know, those are the things which lead people to make very unwise decisions often, and it can become overwhelming and isolating for them. So thank you. That's a really good first step just to for people to get going. Now, it's been so fascinating and we could talk for ages, but I know we've got to wrap up. So if people want to find out more about you, Ellie, and do some work with you, where would they go to find out?
Absolutely. So the best place to contact me is on Instagram at This Girl Talks Money. I'm also on TikTok at the same address. If you've got any questions or inquiries, then have a look at my website, which is thisgirltalksmoney.com. And you can check out the podcast as well. And our recent episode with Caro as well, which is brilliant, is called Money Unfiltered. So you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube.
That's great. Yeah. And there's just so many topics that you covered. So I will definitely put a link to all of those in the show notes, because people will definitely want to follow up and find out more. It's just so inspiring that you're sort of tackling this tricky topic with so many people in the younger generation to enable them to have a different financial view, outcome, education, because as you said earlier, you know, money is power. So thank you so much. And also thank you everyone for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week ahead. Earn lots of lovely money and with the least amount of stress. Until next time, let's catch up super soon. Thanks for listening to the Earn More, Stress Less podcast with me, Caro Sison. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, then do hit subscribe so we can catch up again soon. And please kindly leave a review if you've got a moment, and share with anyone else that you think this podcast could help on their self-employed journey. If you're ready to make bigger breakthroughs in your business life and want to get way more organized and understand your finances the really simple way, then start your very own 14-day free trial today using the super powerful software tool Pocket PA that I made for my own son and daughter. Go to pocketpa.com/podcast and let's get you on the way to earning more money and stressing much less. Have a great week, whatever you're doing.